Imagine looking your father in the eye and basically saying, "I cannot wait for you to die. Like, I wish you were dead right now, so just give me my money."
Right. Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's a horrifying thing to say even today.
Oh, absolutely. But it's not just some rebellious teenager acting out, right? Like in the ancient Middle East, that was essentially the equivalent of social murder.
Oh, totally. It was unthinkable.
And yet, that is exactly how one of the most, famous stories in history actually begins. Which brings us to our mission for today's deep dive. Welcome, everyone. We are so glad you're here.
Glad to be diving into this one. It's a classic.
It really is. Today, we're looking at the parable of the prodigal son from Luke chapter 15. And look, when you think of a Sunday school lesson, you probably picture one of those old felt boards,
Yeah.
brightly colored cutouts, simple morality
The
tales.
good guys, the bad guys. A very neat little lesson at the end.
Exactly. You've heard it a dozen times. A rebellious kid runs away, blows his money, hits rock bottom, comes home, and his forgiving dad gives him a big hug. It's sweet. But today, our goal is to completely blow up that sanitized reading.
Because that traditional reading, honestly, it misses so much.
It really does. So, using some incredible research on first century Middle Eastern culture and ancient Jewish metaphors, we're going to uncover the radical, genuinely shocking cultural shifts hidden in this text.
Yeah, we really want to see how this story transforms from a simple moral tale into this masterclass on subversive love, honor, and shame.
Right, and hopefully it's something that can deeply strengthen your faith by revealing what's actually going on beneath the surface.
Because, I mean, to the original Jewish audiences listening to Jesus in the first century, he wasn't just telling a heartwarming story.
No, not at all.
He was systematically dismantling the cultural rules of his day, like brick by brick. Every single detail he included in this narrative was a deliberate shock to the system for the people listening.
They would have been gasping, right? At points
Yeah.
where we just politely nod today.
Absolutely. They would have been absolutely floored.
Okay, let's unpack this and start right at the inciting incident. The younger son walks up to his father and asks for his share of the estate. Now, on the surface, to a modern listener, maybe that just sounds like a kid who's impatient to get his inheritance. Like he just wants to cash out his trust fund a few years early.
Right. And that modern lens completely misses the profound social violence of what's happening here.
Social violence. Wow.
Yeah, because in an ancient Middle Eastern agrarian culture, inheritance wasn't just, a liquid bank account you could just withdraw from. Inheritance was transferred strictly upon the father's death.
Right.
It was land, it was livestock, it was the family's survival, basically. And it was their standing in the community. It was everything that gave the family a name and a place in the world.
Wait, let me make sure I fully grasp this. So, if the inheritance is tied up in the physical land and the livestock, he isn't just asking for a loan, is he? He's forcing his father to liquidate a portion of the family's actual livelihood.
Exactly. To give the son his share, the father would literally have to sell off ancestral land.
Oh, wow.
And in that culture, land was passed down through generations. Selling it was a massive public disgrace.
So it's a huge deal.
Right. By asking for his share early, the son is effectively saying to his father's face, "Your life means nothing to me. Only your death benefits me. And since you won't die, give me what's mine so I can leave."
That is just staggering. I mean, I tried to think of a modern equivalent earlier, like a spoiled trust fund kid demanding his money. But even that doesn't capture the sheer malice of it, does it?
No, it really doesn't.
Because this isn't just about money. It's about publicly erasing the father's value and dignity while he's still breathing. It's infinitely more disrespectful,
Yeah.
which makes me wonder if the father knows this is a massive public humiliation. What would a normal patriarch of that era actually do in response?
Well, a traditional patriarch of that era would have beaten the son.
Really, just straight up beating them.
Oh, absolutely. He would have physically driven him off the property. You have to remember the mechanics of that society, right? Honor and shame were the absolute currency of the culture.
Right.
To let a son speak to you this way without violent discipline wasn't just a private family issue. It was a public scandal. The
Yeah.
community would fully expect the father to make an example of the boy to maintain order and respect.
But the father in the story doesn't do that. He doesn't yell, he doesn't strike him.
No, and this is the first radical shift in the narrative. The father silently grants the request.
Unbelievable.
He willingly absorbs the humiliation. He literally tears his estate and his life's work, honestly, apart to give this boy what he wants. He allows himself to be publicly shamed in order to give the son the freedom he is demanding.
He pays the social cost himself. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So the son has essentially killed his father socially. He takes the money and he runs. He heads to a, quote, distant country.
Yeah.
And, predictably, things go spectacularly wrong, right?
Yeah, of course they do.
He squanders the wealth, a severe famine hits the land, and he finds himself at absolute rock bottom.
And we really need to look at the details of that rock bottom, because they are highly specific. The text tells us he attaches himself to a Gentile citizen of that country to feed pigs.
Right. And to a modern ear, feeding pigs just sounds like a gross, smelly farm job, you know?
Yeah.
You picture a guy covered in mud, wishing he was anywhere else. But for a Jewish boy in the first century, this is a whole different level of degradation, isn't it?
It is the ultimate degradation. For a first century Jew, pigs were the supreme symbol of ritual impurity and uncleanness.
Right.
It traces straight back to the dietary impurity laws in Leviticus 11.7. Tending to swine meant the son hadn't just made some bad financial investments.
He hadn't just lost his wallet.
Exactly. It meant he had completely abandoned his covenant with God. He had abandoned his family, and he had entirely shed his Jewish identity to become utterly dependent on a Gentile.
So he's not just broke. He is, like, spiritually and culturally dead.
Precisely. He had crossed a line from which you simply do not return. In the eyes of his community back home, he was already a ghost.
Wow. Which brings us to what we usually think of as the turning point of the story, right? The text says he, quote, came to his senses. And the traditional Sunday school reading is that this is his big moment of holy repentance.
Right, the tearful realization.
Exactly. We picture him weeping, realizing how terribly he broke his dad's heart, and deciding to go back and make amends out of pure love. But when you actually look closely at the source material, that's not really what's happening, is it?
Not at all. We have to look at what actually triggers this realization. When he comes to his senses, he doesn't suddenly have a revelation about his father's love. What he actually realizes is that even his father's hired servants eat better than he does.
Wow.
He is quite literally starving to death in a famine, and he remembers that back home, there is bread.
Wait, wait. So his big apology speech, the whole, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. Make me like one of your hired servants." It was just a calculated survival strategy.
What's fascinating here is that, yes, it was.
He figures out a way to pay off his debt so he doesn't starve in a pigsty. Doesn't that make his return entirely selfish?
It is entirely selfish. His plan is fundamentally transactional. It's not born of pure, holy repentance. It's born of basic survival instinct.
He just wants a meal.
Exactly. He doesn't understand his father's grace at all. He thinks he has to go back and negotiate a labor contract. He plans to offer himself as a hired hand so he can slowly, day by day, work off the massive debt he owes the estate.
So he's still thinking in terms of economics and merit.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks he can earn his way back into the perimeter of the family, even just as an employee.
Right.
But by doing that, he is massively underestimating the danger waiting for him back home. Because from what I understand of this culture, he can't just casually stroll back down the main street of his village and, like, hand in his resume.
He absolutely cannot. And this is where the cultural mechanics of a first century village become crucial to understanding the story. If a Jewish boy lost his family inheritance among Gentiles and dared to return to his community, the village had a very specific, terrifying protocol for dealing with him.
Oh, man. What was it?
It was called the kazaza ceremony.
The kazaza, meaning the cutting off.
Yeah.
Right. What did that actually look like in practice?
Well, the village operated as a collective. When this boy lost his wealth to Gentiles, he didn't just shame his father, he betrayed the entire community.
Got it.
So if he was spotted coming back, the men of the village would gather, they would bring a large clay pot, and they would smash it on the ground in front of him.
Just...
And as it shattered, they would shout, "You are cut off from your people."
A permanent severing.
Exactly. From that moment on, he would be completely shunned. Total social isolation. No one would be allowed to speak to him, to trade with him, or to hire him.
He couldn't even buy food.
Right. He wouldn't be able to buy food or find shelter. It was an absolute final rejection.
So this kid is walking back towards his village, rehearsing his little transactional apology speech, completely unaware that he is walking into a trap.
He has no idea.
He thinks he's going to negotiate a job, but the village is getting the clay pot ready to destroy his life forever. But then the father flips the entire script. The text says the father sees him from a long way off, and then the father runs.
Which, according to scholars of Middle Eastern culture, like Kenneth Bailey, this would have been the single most startling, scandalous moment in the entire story for the original audience listening to Jesus.
Because dignified, grown men in that culture didn't jog, did they?
No, never. A respected patriarchal nobleman never ran. It was considered deeply undignified.
I can imagine.
To run, a man in that era had to gather up his long, heavy tunic. He had to expose his bare legs.
Oh, wow.
Doing so meant abandoning all of his honor and dignity in public. It was intensely humiliating.
But the father knows exactly what the village is going to do to his boy. Like, yeah. He knows about the Kazaza.
Yes. The father knows that if the village reaches the boy first, the boy is finished.
Right.
So when he sees his son from afar, he hikes up his robes, exposes his legs, and sprints through the center of the town, kicking up dust for everyone to see.
Here's where it gets really interesting. He is deliberately taking on public shame to intercept the son before the village can get to him with that clay pot.
Exactly.
He essentially acts as a human shield.
He beats them to it. And by throwing his arms around the boy and kissing him in full view of the entire village, he sends a definitive, undeniable signal to everyone watching.
What's the signal?
He's saying, to reject this boy is to reject me. I am claiming him.
Man, that completely changes how I picture this scene.
Yeah.
The father's humiliating run isn't just about an emotional dad being excited to see his kid.
Mm-hmm.
It is a profound physical manifestation of grace.
It really is.
He is literally absorbing the shame and the judgment of the law and the community so his son doesn't have to. He pays the cost.
He pays the cost entirely. And notice what happens next, because the son still doesn't quite get it.
Oh, yeah.
The son tries to launch into his rehearsed transactional apology.
Right. The son starts his pitch. He says, Father, I have sinned against heaven, and you, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Like, he's trying to get to the part where he asks for the hired servant job so he can start working off his debt.
But the father doesn't even let him finish the sentence.
He just cuts him off.
Right.
Yeah. Before the son can even get to the pitch about becoming a servant, the father turns away from him and starts issuing immediate commands to his slaves. He absolutely refuses to entertain the idea of the son paying him back.
And the specific items the father commands his slaves to bring are deeply symbolic, too.
Yeah.
He asks for a robe, a ring, and sandals. Why these three things?
Let's break down the mechanism of each one. First, the best robe.
Okay.
This isn't just any nice piece of clothing pulled from a jest closet. In an ancient household, the best robe was the father's own robe.
Wow.
By taking his own robe and wrapping the son in it, the father is covering the boy's filth and shame with his own personal honor. It represents a complete, immediate restoration of his position in the family.
And comes the ring.
The signet ring.
Right.
This was the ancient equivalent of a corporate credit card and a legal signature.
Oh, I see.
By placing it on the son's finger, the father instantly transfers the authority of the family name back to the boy. He can now do business on behalf of the family again.
And finally, the sandals.
Yeah.
Which to us just sounds like he needed some shoes because he walked a long way. But it meant something entirely different back then.
It was a crucial visual marker. Slaves and hired servants went barefoot.
Yeah.
Only free men and sons wore shoes in the house. By demanding sandals for the boy's feet, the father definitively, visibly rejects the son's offer to become a hired servant.
It's like a guy showing up in dirty rags to beg for a job in the mailroom,
mm-hmm.
You know, hoping he can slowly work off $1 million embezzlement over the next 50 years. And before he can even finish his apology, the CEO interrupts him, hands him the keys to the corner office, gives him the corporate black card, and says, welcome back to the board of directors.
That is exactly the dynamic. The son is restored entirely by unmerited grace. The father completely rejects the idea that the son could ever pay off his debt. The debt is forgiven, not financed.
It's breathtaking when you see all those cultural mechanics working together. Now look, if this were a standard Hollywood movie, the music would swell right here. They'd walk into the feast and the credits would roll. Happy ending.
But it doesn't end there.
No. The parable doesn't end with the younger son's return. There is a whole other act. And honestly, you could argue this next part is a true climax of the story.
It is the climax. And to understand why, we have to look closely at who Jesus was actually talking to. This brings us to the older brother.
Let's talk about that target audience. Why did Jesus tell this story in the first place?
If you look at the very beginning of the chapter, Luke 15.2 gives us the context. Jesus was directing this parable specifically at the Pharisees and the religious scholars.
The rule keepers.
Exactly. These were the cultural elites, the strict rule keepers, and they were openly criticizing Jesus for eating and associating with sinners and tax collectors. For a Pharisee, eating with someone wasn't just a social event.
Right.
It meant you were identifying with them, which made you ceremonially unclean.
So Jesus is eating with the rule breakers, the people who act exactly like the younger brother.
Yes. And the older brother in the story is a direct mirror of those religious leaders. He represents the people who stayed home and kept all the rules.
And the older brother is furious. He's out in the fields, he hears the music, finds out his disgraced younger brother is back and is being thrown a massive party, and he flat out refuses to go inside. His father has to come out to him, and the older brother just explodes. He says, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders."
Yeah, he's so bitter.
Now, I'm going to push back here for a second, because I think a lot of people listening secretly sympathize with the older brother. Doesn't he have a valid point?
It's a common reaction, for sure.
I mean, if I'm the older brother, I am furious too. I stayed. I worked the fields in the hot sun. I didn't bankrupt the family. I didn't shame our name. And this kid comes back after ruining everything and he gets a barbecue. It feels incredibly unfair.
It does feel unfair if you view your relationship with the father as a contract.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what the older brother's dialogue reveals. Notice the specific word he uses, slaving. All these years I've been slaving for you. He doesn't view himself as a son who shared in the father's joy. He views himself as an employee trying to earn a wage. He thinks his strict obedience is a currency he is using to buy his father's favor and guarantee his inheritance.
Which means he was trying to control the father through his good behavior, just like the younger brother tried to control the father through rebellion. They both just wanted the father's stuff.
Exactly.
The younger one broke the rules to get the wealth, and the older one followed the rules to get the wealth. Neither of them actually loved the father.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is the profound theological breakthrough Jesus is offering to his audience here. There are actually two kinds of lostness in this story.
Right.
We always focus on the younger brother because his lostness is obvious. He was lost in his rebellion and his law breaking.
You can see him in the pigsty. It's visible.
Right. But the older brother is equally lost. He is lost in his moral superiority, his entitlement, and his law-keeping. Both of them were completely alienated from the father's heart.
That's incredible.
Jesus is telling the Pharisees, you can be just as lost sitting in the pew, perfectly following every single rule because you think God owes you a reward, as you can be out in the world breaking every rule.
That completely flips the script on what it means to be good. And the father's response to this older, self-righteous son is just as culturally shocking as his response to the younger one, isn't it?
It is, because think about what the father has to do to even have this conversation.
He has to go outside.
The father has to leave the party. He leaves his own feast, which in that culture was a celebration of his life and his honor, to go outside into the dark and plead with his angry older son.
And culturally, for a patriarch to do that.
It is another massive absorption of humiliation.
That's howling it on.
Yep. A patriarch shouldn't have to leave his own feast. He certainly shouldn't have to beg a son to enter. The older son's public refusal to come in is a massive insult to the father's honor in front of all the guests and the entire village.
Yeah, that's a huge slight.
But the father humbles himself all over again. He goes out into the dark to plead with the self-righteous son, just as he ran out in the daylight to shield the rebellious son.
He relentlessly pursues both of them, no matter the cost to his own pride. And then the story just stops. It's a cliffhanger.
It really is.
We don't get to find out if the older brother drops his anger and goes into the party, yeah, or if he stays outside in the dark, clinging to his pride and his ledgers of who owes who.
Jesus left the ending deliberately unresolved because it wasn't just a story. It was an open invitation and a stark warning to the religious elite standing right in front of him.
Wow.
He was essentially asking them, I am showing you the true heart of God. Will you drop your scorecards, come in, and celebrate with the broken people I have redeemed? Or will you stay outside in the dark with your pride?
So what does this all mean? When we take all of this together, the sheer disrespect of the death wish, the reality of the pigsty, the scandal of the running patriarch shielding his son from the village, the robes and rings, and this brilliant exposure of two different kinds of lostness. How does understanding all this cultural machinery transform things for you and me today?
It completely transforms our understanding of God's character. It shows us that grace isn't just a polite clinical pardon handed down from a distant judge.
Right.
It's about a God who is willing to absorb immense public shame. A God who will hike up his robes and sprint toward us, dismantling social norms and risking everything to bring us safely home.
That's beautiful.
And he does this relentlessly, whether we are the rebellious rule breaker wallowing in the mess we made or the self-righteous rule keeper standing outside judging everyone else. The Father's grace is aggressively pursuing both.
It really makes you rethink that old felt board. Mm-hmm. You aren't just looking at a nice dad and a naughty kid. We're looking at a love that literally shatters the rules of society to restore the broken, which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. Since Jesus left the story unresolved on purpose, the pen is kind of handed over to you, the listener.
Yeah, it's up to you now.
Ask yourself, which brother's lostness do you relate to more right now? Are you the one running away from the table, convinced you've made too much of a mess to ever come back? Or are you standing right outside the door judging the guest list, refusing to go inside because you're still trying to earn a seat that you already own?
That's the real question.
Something to think about. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep looking past the surface, and we'll catch you next time.